Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is the Talk with Tenny show, and I am Lauren Tenny. I hope you're all doing well tonight, and we have a fascinating show lined up. We will be having a conversation with Dr. Bonnie Burstow, who is a faculty member at Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto and a very long-time psychiatry activist. In her bio, it says approximately 35 years. I am absolutely thrilled that Bonnie is going to be joining us, and I'm going to bring her in right now. Dr. Bonnie Burstow?
You got me.
Hi, you're on live. How are you? Thanks for calling in.
You're very welcome.
Thanks. I was just beginning to read a little bit about your bio and so that you sent me, and I thank you for sending me all this great information. Dr. Burstow is also a feminist therapist, a prison abolitionist, a left-wing anarchist, and a prolific author. Examples of organizations and events which she has chaired over the years include the Ontario Coalition Against Electroshock, Resistance Against Psychiatry, the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, and the First Psych Out Conference. Examples of her publications are Radical Feminist Therapy, Working in the Context of Violence, Shrink Resistant, co-edited with Don Weitz, A Rose by Any Other Name, Naming and the Battle Against Psychiatry in Mad Matters, and the much-anticipated, soon-to-be-released anthology of which she is first editor, Psychiatry Disrupted, which is coming out in McGill-Queen University Press very soon. Dr. Burstow, it is an honor and a privilege to be able to talk with you tonight. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Based on what it is you had sent me, I'm wondering if we can start with just what's wrong with psychiatry and in what ways is it worse today than it was 40 years ago, and what are some of the difficulties and the critical importance of mounting resistance to psychiatry?
That's a tall order. Those are all, like, huge topics. So I think you asked first what was wrong with psychiatry?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
You know, it's easy to ask what's wrong with psychiatry, and we could be on for 2 hours talking about nothing like about except that. It's almost impossible to say what's right with psychiatry. Psychiatry is dehumanizing. Psychiatry brain damages people. Psychiatry deprives people of their freedom and their authentic being in the world. But I think, you know, even more fundamental than that, if that were not bad enough, psychiatry has no foundation. Its treatments, its diseases are social constructs, and social constructs that don't connect all that well up with the world. You know, we all use social constructs. These ones pretend to be real diseases, to be something other than the pathologization of deviants. They are, in fact, are not. They have been looking for chemical imbalances. They have been looking for proof of brain damage in the people they project these labels onto for 50-some-odd years. Strangely, they haven't found them, and they haven't found them because they're not there. So
right.
If we look at something which has absolutely no foundation, which deprives people of their freedom, and which brain damages people, that's what's wrong with psychiatry. Not much to recommend it when you look at that.
No, not much at all. And, you know, I think that for, you know, one of the things that I was listening to the interview that you had done with Alex Abramovich some time ago, I guess. And
yeah, but
In there, you had talked about how you view teaching and research and activism and therapy all as coming in a way that most people don't have them, that you have a more integrated process to all of this. And so for people who may not being aware of, like, what a social construct is and how that operates in, like, the world of academia. Could you give a couple of just examples of how concretely these
well,
are social constructs?
You know, on some level, everything is a social construct. So, we're social beings. But there's another level on which constructs can connect up in meaningful ways with the world. So if somebody comes up with the construct of heart disease or heart attack, there really are things that can connect up with this that relate to the physiology of the human being. There is nothing that relates to the physiology of the human being in so-called mental disorders. And in that sense, it's a social construct with no anchor.
Right.
And it's a social construct that ultimately serves one profession, the profession of psychiatry, which does not serve the people subjected to it.
No, not in any way, in that these are crimes against humanity. I mean, when you just talk even just brain damage, like if you know something causes brain damage as a doctor or as somebody who claims to be part of a human helping service profession, how could you willingly and knowingly inflict this on another person, especially without informed consent or,
an informed consent is a misnomer. If you said, you know, I'm going to give you ECT. Now, it has no effectiveness beyond 6 weeks. It will destroy your memory, and it will brain damage you for life. Nobody would consent to it. So
right.
There, the idea of informed consent, you know, is a mirage.
Absolutely, and still, like, not even being told, like, in the States that this is still an experimental device, that it's, you know, was grandfathered.
And in Canada either. CAMH, which is the shock shop of Ontario, the consent form that people sign says, my doctor has explained everything to me and I understand it and I give my consent. There is not one bit of fact at all listed. Not these are the side effects, these are nothing.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to thinking in terms of, like, electroshock is a good example because this is something that's been going on for 70-some-odd years now, right? That since its beginning, that people have never been informed that this has been known to cause brain damage. The earliest reports of this were specifically to, shock and control inmates. And the way that it, your work, the way that it's been, which you shine light on how it's been disproportionately used on women and how women are subject to this crime against humanity, that this is torture. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about what inspired you to do this and what people should know about.
To write about women and electroshock and specifically?
Right. Yes.
Well, I got involved in the battle against electroshock in the very early 80s. And I was certainly aware of electroshock because I had a family member who'd had it. And I was certainly not happy about electroshock. At one point, a number of us formed something called the Ontario Coalition to Stop Electroshock. And so we were seeing, you know, the mounting damage by electroshock. And certainly at that point I was committed. But I can tell you that after the hearings, we created hearings into electroshock. We held them in the council chamber of City Hall. And after those hearings, the world was never quite the same for me because person after person got up and talked about the enormous damage, but you could hear the enormity of the gender difference. And you knew that no matter what the literature said, women, it's not only that women were electroshocked 2 to 3 times as much as men, they were more brain damaged by it. And there was no question that they were more brain damaged by it. There was no question that their memory was more affected by it. You could hear it in the testimony. You could hear woman after woman talk about how they lost 5 years of their life, 10 years of their life. And it, and you know, for a long time, it wasn't until Sackheim 2007 that they actually came up with an indicator where they said, oh, women are more damaged by it than men. But sitting in those hearings that we created, I could tell, you could tell just from the testimony, women were more damaged. So take a look at that. 2 to 3 times as many more women than men. And who is it when we're giving to? When we give it to women more than 2 to 3 times as many as often as men, we are giving it to the people most brain damaged by it. That was horrific. Listening to the ways it ripped people's lives asunder was horrific. And listening to the ways in which a kind of battery on women was happening was horrifying. And, you know, it wasn't a woman in my family that was given electroshock. It was a man, and I could not help but see the enormity of the difference.
That is just amazing, and that despite all of these women and men testifying during the court hearings, there still is no ban or moratorium on electroshock in Canada. Is that right?
There's no moratorium. There never was a moratorium. Now, way back in the 80s, the Board of Health called for a moratorium pending a hearing, pending an investigation, but there never was a moratorium, and electroshock has slowly grown over the decades. You know, it's never stopped. It's and it's always been on the rise, and at certain eras, the shocking of the elderly also rises disproportionately, just as the shocking of women does. So, and again, who have we found from Sackheim, as well as other studies, that are more damaged by electroshock than other people? The elderly. Exactly who they're giving it. The elderly, then, and women is a very frightening combination. And, you know, I remember once interviewing for a film I made on called When Women End Up in Those Horrible Places about psychiatry in Canada, and I remember Helen Levine saying, you know, that she's almost 70, and it's ironic remembering this because I'm almost 70. She said, "I'm almost 70 now, and I think about what's in store for me, and when I think that it's electroshock, I can't imagine after all my years of service this is what it would come to." So you look at that, and you look at the profound attack on women, in particular older women.
Yeah. So in this is just so devastating, and in the United States it's the same. And in New York, the person most likely to get electroshocked is a woman over 60 years of age in New York. And so it's these things that are happening either in the States or in Canada or anywhere in the world.
In the world it's happening. The statistics are the same everywhere in the world. They have also been almost the same for every decade in which electroshock has been given. So the reality of the oppression is crystal clear.
And so, matter what the diagnostic labels, this fraud that the DSM wants to call itself science and has everybody believing that perpetrating such crimes against people with the DSM as if it's valid or reliable.
When the ECT review committee. Because the government did strike a committee to look into ECT, and I can tell you something about that. That was a terrible waste of our time. But when they looked into electroshock, one of the things they discovered was, yes, because the argument of the doctors was women are more depressed than men, and this is a diagnosis specific, and depression is specifically recommended for ECT. So the other way around, ECT is recommended for depression. But what the review committee found is that women were given 2 to 3 times as much shock as men, irrespective of diagnosis. So the diagnosis is an excuse. Right. And irrespective of diagnosis, they were given the shock. So it didn't matter what people thought their presenting problems were, they were given shock. It didn't matter what people thought their eventual problem was after you know, applying the DSM categories, they were given shock.
Right. So whatever we're going to call it, then you know, we're going to give you shock whichever way it goes. And I know also with children that this has been an issue over time and that it's still legal to use on children.
Well, in some areas, in some jurisdictions it is illegal and some it isn't. You know, I mean, there are children electroshocked.
Right. And so I'm just wondering, like, what do you think it is about how, like, society is conditioned to, A, fear us that, you know, every time that there's some kind of violent thing, the media jumps on it to condition psychiatric labels with violence, but then also just conditioned by psychiatry and by what psychiatry is presenting despite that there's no evidence, that there's no biological evidence, there's no tests, there's no anything. How does this field of psychiatry still get people to buy into it over time, and has that changed at all?
Well, that's a huge story. See, on the one hand, there always was a degree of terror around people deemed mad, okay? So before psychiatry gained the dominion it did, there were always... But not in the whipped up way today. So if we go back to the Elizabethan period, you know, they incarcerated. You've heard of Bedlam, which is it's famous in Shakespeare's plays, and the notorious Bedlam, and then where they incarcerated people. At any given time in the Elizabethan period, there was about 20 people incarcerated there. They locked up almost nobody, so they weren't anywhere near as afraid of them as they became later, and the fear rose as the medical profession rose. So the medical profession was instrumental, absolutely instrumental in fanning the fear people have of otherness that they think of as mad. Major problem. Studies additionally show, I mean, psychiatry is on the bandwagon for what's called anti-stigma campaigns, but what studies show is that when they say there's nothing to be afraid of, this is just a mental illness, what they show is that with the use of the medical model, the fear rises. People are much more afraid of this strange disease than they are of unusual behavior, or behavior they don't quite know how to understand. So, in fact, the psychiatric profession and the medical profession generally have been instrumental in raising the fear of the so-called mad or the so-called mentally ill.
And almost the level of constructedness behind it, since they're also the people who seem to profit from it.
They're definitely the people who profit for it. So one of the ways they have risen as a profession is precisely by fanning the fear, but the other way they rose was a kind of ruthlessness. Let's be clear, if we go back to earlier times, many people were in some ways vying for competition of who was going to control the madness turf, because there was money to be made from the madness turf. And some of the people were not especially greedy, right? Medicine was not one of them. Medicine was definitely a profession which wanted to monopolize this territory and make it grow. So there were the women healers and psychiatry, you know, medicine drove them out, declared them witches, etc.
Right.
There was the astrologers. And, you know, if we go to 17th century England, the astrologers were much more popular among the common folk than the doctors were, more popular. The medical profession lobbied for and received permission from Parliament to fine astrologers for working and so on. Bit by bit, they drove out their competitors and enlarged their kingdom.
And also now labeled
them
mad,
because
if you call yourself an astrologer now, right? Because this is grounds for being, you know, diagnosed with today, that you have some kind of spiritual healing ability or the ability to commune with other people that people can't necessarily see or hear. So this is, and I think that this is part of what you're all putting forth in Psychiatry Disrupted, right? Is this part of what's coming out, or is this from the psych out proceedings? I kind of remember.
I'm not sure what you're asking. Try again.
Oh, just this history of looking at, like, the astrologers.
The history of looking at, you know, in the book that I am currently negotiating with a publisher over, it's called Psychiatry and the Business of Madness. It's my very latest book, and I'm in the process right now of negotiating with a publisher. In that one, among other things, I have two chapters on the history and the rise of psychiatry and the history it took and how we got from, you know, the situation decades and decades and decades earlier to what we have today.
Right, and I think
what
it's
the fights were, what they looked like, and why, in fact, psychiatry brought in the medical model. I mean, this was, you know, this details, among other things, this book details that kind of rise. Now, it's not primarily a history book, but there is substantial history in it because one needs to understand the history to know what, in fact, it is we're facing today.
Right, absolutely. And I think that this idea that these were largely women who were in these roles of astrologers and such, who were then being, you know,
reorganized. No, actually, the women weren't the astrologers. The women were the wise women healers. The astrologers were mainly men.
Okay.
And both the astrologers and the women were popular. But, you know, what they weren't were the medical profession. The medical profession essentially made war on all these other professions, drove them out, and, of course, key in that droving out was the driving out of the women healers.
But how did they do it, and how do they remain to be able to do it today without any evidence?
Because they're doctors. I mean, paralleling, and what psychiatry did was piggyback on the huge rise of medicine in the first place. We so assume medicine that we forget that to get the powerful empire they did, that was the work of many centuries, and in many instances, and in some instances anyway, they deserved the reputation, you know, in the sense that they found a way of getting around epidemics and stopping epidemics, so they actually were of use to the common good. Psychiatry rode on that reputation while not remotely being, you know, a horse of the same color. So, but they made it look like they were. And so they could trade off the credibility that everyday people gave medicine, when in fact they weren't medical. And then when that started looking terribly obvious to people in the 70s that this was not medical, that this had no credibility, they then further medicalized. And that's when we got the DSM-3 coming out, that where everything was a symptom, and there were lists of symptoms. That's when we got all the models to make it look and dressed up in the garb of medicine. In the 70s, psychiatry had a chance of disappearing, and this was its fight back, and it won the fight. It won the fight. Now, to some extent, it won the fight because, you know, it has a partner, the state. You know, the state wants somebody in charge, and here was clearly the group that the state started putting psychiatry in charge in the 18th century, and it got stronger and stronger. Originally, it wasn't psychiatry, but the state always wanted to put somebody in charge.
Right, and that's to influence their state power and what allows them to do all this to us at force, or with force. So this idea of how the state...
There are two state powers involved. One is called parens patriae. It's a very patriarchal concept, and the concept is that the king, because it was originally the king that had it, it went to psychiatry later, that the king is like the father of his country and so can take care of people who can't take care of themselves. So that was one state power. The other is police power, and that's the power to stop people and lock them up if they are endangering the public good. Those two powers came together. The trick of psychiatry was to pretend they were the same, to pretend that when you lock people up to protect the so-called the peace, that's, you know, that's for their own good and part of being a good father. So psychiatry managed to meld those two together. But those are the state powers, and they have been the state powers by which all this has been justified, you know, for century after century. You can trace it right back to the old English times.
And that they can still do this today with no biological evidence of any of it. And so this idea of benevolence, of this veil of, like, they're doing something good for us when they're really, like, causing brain damage and killing us and controlling us, how does that, you know, that I love what you had said before, that there's a degree of terror that's been involved, you know, all the way back.
There's definitely terror involved. And, you know, and there's definitely a sense involved that there are these people of danger to other people, and we need to lock them up to protect everyone. And then we can also say it's for their own good, but we need to lock them up to protect everyone. You know, in France, the rise of the psychiatric institution totally paralleled the rise of the prisons. This was, among other things, the control of the dangerous classes.
Mm.
But if you can then say, actually, we're curing them, you can get away with a whole lot. You can do almost anything to people if you say, it's actually, this isn't really for practice, this is for their own good because they're in trouble and we need to protect them.
Right, and then you get both sides, you know, we're watching it happen with them. I saw a press release from the Mental Health America the other day calling that they're hoping that this new legislation that would be bipartisan would affect both late-stage mental illnesses and early intervention, prevention, and screening and treatment, you know. And so I'm trying to now figure out, and if anybody knows out there, what this late-stage mental illness is, as if it's like stage 4 cancer or something. You know what I mean? Like, this new term that I'm hearing for the first time.
We always hear new terms, and why we hear new terms is more than is the psychiatry is a growth industry. It's a growth industry, and in order to keep it growing, you have to have more and more people under its control. So you need more and more concepts and diagnoses in order to get those under its control. You need to suddenly discover that all the youth are sick. And the enormous, the 37-fold rise in the so-called the so-called mental illness of children, that's not a rise in, quote, mental illness, unquote. That is a rise of being declared mentally ill. See, it is in someone's interest. Now, late stage, well, you can find another way to bring it in. You know, these are all concepts that serve one purpose, the growth of psychiatry. It's all it serves.
It's like a cancer.
And, yeah, and it's a, you know, the system serves the system. It doesn't serve the people in it. And nothing,
right.
You know, and that's terribly clear. If you look at any part of the system, what is the purpose of those parts? It's to perpetuate the system.
Right, and yet we know about things and alternatives that people could utilize at much less cost. That wouldn't
That's
really
not be, in psychiatry's interest.
No, not at all. And so then anybody who supports any kind of alternative or challenges psychiatry is themselves not seen as credible. And
or it gets gobbled up by psychiatry. So they say, of course. I mean, if you talk to the ministries of health, they'll say, of course we give alternatives. We let people have therapy. We let people have. But if you take a look, there's a minuscule amount of money spent on alternatives, and they're subordinated to psychiatry in the first place. They're not all that good. And a maximal amount of money to keeping people under mental chains, which is what the drugs do. The drugs incarcerate the.
Absolutely, and this is social control on so many levels, and you know, to really get the information out. But as an academic, I mean, how do people, when everybody around you is pushing this other, you know, drumbeat, how have you, for your career, survived being able to speak out against psychiatry and organize against psychiatry. Like
organizing is a different thing. I don't need academia to organize, but to educate, I have needed academia, and it's complicated. You know, it's complicated. One of the things I've done is introduce anti-psychiatry analyses into a huge number of courses that I teach. And, I rely, in order to do that, on academic freedom, right? That people can't just come into my classroom and tell me what I can teach. I also rely on the fact that, you know, that students, in the end, feel that something good has happened to them in this process. So I'll give you an example. I introduced a course on working with survivors of trauma into OISE. There was no such mm-hmm. course, and in fact, there was nothing like it at U of T, and still isn't. And what happened, you know, and what I was terribly aware of is if I go into almost anywhere else in the world where trauma and working with trauma is discussed, the diagnoses such as post-traumatic stress disorder are inherent in it, and they are not in how I teach it. And in addition to that, psychiatry is theorized as an institution which you can bring in to help traumatized people. In other words, a resource. When I teach the course, the whole concept of what psychiatry role is turned on its head. So we don't use medical model language. We don't. But in addition to that, psychiatry comes in a unique way, not as a resource, but as a threat to people who are traumatized. So if someone's too traumatized, we have to figure out how to safeguard them from psychiatry, because that's what everyone will think. In addition, psychiatry comes in as one of the many traumatizing institutions that traumatize people. So you can see, at that point, this trauma course doesn't look like any other trauma course in the world. That's the main way in which I have spread it in academia, and sometimes I've had huge fights, but not about my classes. Sometimes I've had a few fights. There were fights over the PsychOut conference. Sometimes there were fights over my classes, but not from my colleagues, usually from one particular department within university, and I think you would know which one it is, psychiatry. So psychiatry has, at various places I've taught, you know, tried to intervene into what I teach. There was actually one very, very interesting one, and it kind of tells you something about these people. I was teaching a course on communications theory at University of Manitoba, and the head of our department got a letter, and first let me tell you, psychiatry came in only for maybe 10 minutes in the entire course when I was looking at psychiatric nature of communication. 10 minutes in a whole one-year course, nothing. But it upset them, because it upset them that I was teaching something in which they didn't look good. And so they sent a letter to the chair of my department, I was teaching in social work at the time, and said, we are very, very distressed that your students are just getting Bonnie Burstow's view of psychiatry, and in the name of people having exposed to many opinions, we are asking we be allowed to come into a course and teach what a psychiatric perspective is. And the head of the department sent me the letter and said, Bonnie, could you please respond? I don't know what to do with this. And, you know, we'll support you, whatever you want, but tell us what to do. And could you respond back to this person? And I responded back and said, you know, I would be very, very happy, you know, for the broadening of my students' perspective if psychiatrists would come in and teach their perspective along with mine, but only if I'm at the same time invited into the courses that you guys teach to your students, because they only get one perspective, and let me teach my perspective. We never heard from them again. Because that's the last thing they want to do. Want to do is to have their students hear anything except the kind of brain, you know, twisting that their courses are about.
Because it really is indoctrination, and you know, and
it
I've
is indoctrination.
I'm now going into my 10th year of teaching psychology, and I've watched over the last 10 years how the textbooks have even cut out anything about the history of psychology, any of the underside or any of the darkness.
They just
start with biological psychology, first chapter one, boom.
Psychology has kind of I mean, one of the things I look at in my book, Psychiatry and the Business of Madness, is how psychology little by little became colonized by psychiatry, so it was no longer a discipline in its own right. And we've seen that. We've seen that it's not so much in Europe, but it has swept North America. Psychology is incredibly compromised today. And not only psychology, but to varying degrees, social work, nursing, etc. And I examine this in this book, and it's very, very interesting to see what's happened to these other professions. See what happens when one profession rules over all others.
And everything is like a pipeline to psychiatry. So you have
Absolutely.
These kids that are just being psychiatrists. I mean, in New York, they just passed a legislation passed in both the Senate and the Assembly. I'm not sure if the governor has signed it yet. I haven't been able to find out. Mandating, they changed it from postpartum depression. The legislature is now saying that postpartum depression actually begins during pregnancy. So they're changing the language for it to be now maternal depression. And
yeah, of course.
They can
get way more people that way.
Right. And so all women need to be screened and their children for early psychiatric, involvement.
Yeah, appalling. And there's only one group whose interest this is in, one group. And again, it's certainly not mothers, and it's certainly not mothers' children.
No.
I can give you another interesting example of, the enormous disrespect that psychiatry and people who are advocates of psychiatry have for everyone else. You remember the Psychote conference. You came to it, right?
Yes, I do.
So that first Psychote conference in Toronto. Well,
right.
Besides that psychiatry, the Department of Psychiatry, asked the president of the university to stop the conference because they found it such a threatening that anyone would be critiquing them. In addition, there were some people from psychology who did. And one of them wrote the head of my department and said, "I'm sure somebody must be falsely using Bonnie Burstow's name, because I'm sure she would never do a conference of this sort. And so somebody is an imposter is up there pretending, and I want to stop." And so, of course, the chair of the department knew very well there was no imposter. Yes, this was my conference, and got in touch with him, and again asked me to respond to the letter. And among other things, it said, "This is the opposite of what we teach our students. If this is allowed to be taught at this conference, it will confuse our students." And I wrote back and again waited for a response to the letter. And the letter I wrote back said, "My sense is that, graduate students are very bright people. And if you teach one thing in your courses and I teach something different in this conference, they are bright enough to know at the end, after looking at it, what they believe." And that was the end of my statement, but they never responded again. So again, there was a sense of a profound disrespect for the intelligence of other people, and a sense we just have to stop any other thought from being out there. But, to their credit, OISE stood firm, and U of T stood firm. It didn't bow to the Department of Psychiatry, and it didn't bow to these letters.
That's really amazing, and I don't think I knew that. And when we did the psych out follow up or tried to in New York in 2011, the Graduate Center was supportive, but it's rare that people are supportive of speaking out against psychiatry, or even against like a biological version of psychiatry, or even behavioral psychology, or any of that. So, in terms of strategic activism, things that you've been able to do in order to move the agenda and educate people and organize, even beyond academic terms. If you would be willing to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, most of my stuff has not been in academia. I mean, a substantial part of it is, because I am an academic and I do write scholarship. But most of my work has been in this area, has been as an activist. I've I've been part of a huge number of anti-psychiatry organizations. The coalition, you know, the Ontario Coalition to Stop Electroshock, huge, and had enormous, had a certain credibility with the public for a while, in the sense that we were getting on the news every week, we were getting the Board of Health to take up considerations, we were getting the legislature to take up considerations, but I can't say we were astute activists. We made bad mistakes, and we kind of squandered some of the credibility we had by not understanding what good activism looks like. I mean, when I look back on it, we did some really neat stuff, but we really didn't know what a winning strategy was and what a losing strategy was, and we fell into a losing strategy at one point. I was also part of resistance against psychiatry for a huge, huge time now. I've been chair of a coalition against psychiatric assault, and we've also put on public hearings. And right now we're in dialogue with the Law Union of Ontario for putting psychiatry on trial, which I think could be a very educational certain historical figures in psychiatry on trial, which could be a very educational thing for the public.
That would be fabulous. You're going to put Adolf Meyer, I put a vote in for him.
Well, we're Canada, we're kind of forced to put Canadian people on trial,
well,
so
yes,
you and Cameron
I guess
would be high on our list.
Cameron, yeah, well, obviously with the sleeper and rooms, and, you know, that's come up a few times, and do you have any, I don't mean to put you on the spot about that, but would you have, like, in a nutshell, what happened with Cameron and what his ideas were and what he did to people?
Yes, well, I can give you a short rendition. Cameron had a theory that the mind needed to be, that in people with emotional problems or whatever, however he conceived of it, that the only way to deal with it was to wipe the mind totally clear. So he did what, he did shock a few times a day with the idea of wiping every thought out of the brain. So it's called depatterning. So if you get rid of everything someone's thinking, they have no patterns left. And so his sense is that any pattern would be defective because it's a bad person. Get rid of all the patterns. So it was called depatterning. Then once the brain is wiped clean, the next thing he advocated was repatterning. So now you put in new thoughts, which will now serve the person well, into this so-called blank slate that you have created. So, for instance, Velma Orlico was given as a repatterning, and the repatterning was horrendous because what happened is they would be put into a sleep, so they would be in a sleep, but underneath their pillow there would be these recorded messages on a loop that would play over and over again, and these are the thoughts they wanted them to have. So Velma Orlico's, the thought that got repeated over and over again is, you are a bad mother, you are a bad wife. Well, you can take a look and see what that's going to do to a human being and any kind of sense of who they are and what they're about.
Why?
So it was, in the States, people know that the CIA funded this. What I can tell you is the CIA, well, it certainly did fund, was a minor partner. It was primarily funded by Health and Welfare Canada, who gave you and Cameron grant after grant. And it is not because they didn't know what he was doing. He was publishing his experiments in journal after journal. So a horrific tale that, that implicates not simply the bad apples, as it were, but implicates the state.
Right, and having the state that they knew that this is what he was doing, like they
well,
know
he,
what
he wrote
doing
that this
now.
Is what he was doing. There was no cover up in this. It was totally upfront. The only cover up was not letting people know that the CIA was also funding it. But of course, the CIA was very interested in brainwashing experiments, and this was brainwashing, wiping the mind clean,
this
putting
was, this
in
was
new
all
messages.
Part of the MK Ultra.
The MK Ultra, yes.
And so that they would do this, and they would do this repeatedly to all different people, and that this is partially what still is behind some of the thinking when they're doing electroshock today. They're not using it the same way.
They're not saying they're doing it, but if you go to almost all of these treatments, what did the people who pioneered the first parts of them say? We need to destroy the thinking. We need to wipe clear the mind. We need to do damage in order to then, and that's how electroshock got going. That's how the drugs got going. That's how lobotomy got going. All of these, in fact, were given the name by psychiatrists advocating brain-damaging therapeutics. That's what they were called. And it was only when the public was disturbed by the concept of brain damaging that suddenly they changed their discourse, and they talked about the fact that these did not damage the brain, and there was no evidence whatsoever that they damaged the brain.
Right.
We're dealing with one of the most disingenuous professions on the face of the earth.
And I think that this is part of what trying to highlight and what you had said before, that psychiatry is a growth industry. And just if you could connect on a level of social, political, and economic here for a second, and just, you know, do you have any thoughts about how this is, be aware of?
Well, what you need to know now is at this point in time, the more oppressed the group, the more likely they are to be psychiatrized. But let's be honest, that's only since the mid-19th century onward. If you go before the 19th century, the most likely to be psychiatrists were affluent men. Okay? This has been a huge shift over the last 100 years of who the major victims of psychiatry were. At one point, it was, without question, the affluent.
Okay.
Now it's the poverty-stricken. But
because,
you know,
the state pays for it.
But when I say more likely to be subjected, it's absolutely more likely to be subjected. At the same time, the horror of psychiatry is, well, at the same time oppressing the most oppressed the most, it is quite happy to oppress everyone. Again, it is a growth industry, and it wants everybody in its confines. And you can't do a simple oppression analysis. Like, if you do a simple oppression analysis, you would say, okay, so women are given electroshock way more than men, so must be poor women. No, in fact, it's middle and upper middle class white women who are primarily shocked. So none of this is simple or straightforward.
Right, and everyone
now,
in terms of drugs,
it is overwhelmingly, hugely higher percentage people of color given drugs. So in all of these things, we kind of have to give up any simple chance and take a look at who it is. With drugs, it is overwhelmingly people of color. It is overwhelmingly poor people.
Right,
it's the middle class.
I think in the States it's similar along those lines. And also looking at who is court-ordered into psychiatry versus who is coerced into it.
Absolutely.
You know, since the show has started, I've gotten so many calls from people who have talked about while on private insurance, so not being subjected to the state, but being told, well, if you don't go get the electroshock here, then we're going to send you to the state and court-order it on you and you'll get it anyway. And so,
absolutely. And these are, you know, these aspects, we're dealing with a bureaucracy, not only a profession, but a bureaucracy, and all the parts work together. So, you know, I've had huge amounts of people tell me that they were burnt out in their job and they needed to have time off, but they could only get time off if they agreed to diagnosis and if they agreed to take the drugs. Otherwise, they have to go back to work, right? So there's a kind of blackmail involved where you can only get what you want if you're going to take this other part.
Right, and this other part is going to do all kinds of damage to you, including brain damage and
body
damage.
Absolutely.
And so when you look back,
you know, there used to be, you probably remember this, Lauren, there used to be a whole ethos on let's make sure no one falls between the cracks.
Right.
Today, people would give their eye teeth, please let there be cracks so I can fall between them, because you have me caught up wherever I enter the system, I'm trapped into all of it.
Right, and, you know, this new, legislation that just passed the Senate in New York, the headline on the press release was a crack that you could have driven a bus through. You know, and so they still, you know, and this, if it, you know, whatever, it's New York politics, right? But it the rest of the country and the world is basing a lot of what they're doing on New York's involuntary commitment laws.
Yeah, and it's not just New York. There are involuntary commitment laws in almost every state now in the world. There's nowhere to hide. You know,
right.
Once somebody has you, almost nowhere, wherever you go, so it's outpatient committal in the States, it's community treatment orders in Canada, everyone has a comparable law. And as you see, the odd place that doesn't, suddenly they bring it in. This is you know, and I remember when they started bringing this in, I remember survivors telling me, I don't know, I think maybe I have to move to somewhere else, but there's nowhere to move anymore. Because
right,
everyone's brought in this kind of legislation. San Francisco's bringing it.
Right, and so now they're looking at a national database, you know, and they're sneaking that in under the gun stuff, again, this false association. Or if you look at the community treatment orders. But, you know, Sue Wittenberg called in recently talking about how Canadians with a psychiatric history can't get into the States anymore, and that they're
there always was some trouble. There always was, you know, there was always some difficulty. It's just getting harder.
And so being able to get out or escape this or find, you know, asylum, which is a funny word for it, considering what they wound up turning asylums into, is just a continuation. And so, you know, from the 1970s, where you had said earlier that, like, psychiatry almost could have gotten wiped out at that point, that they really won and have come back with a vengeance against people, and they just are in every system and everywhere that they're creeping through. And the profit, again, and this idea of business, the business of madness, I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit.
Well, I called, you know, and my publisher may talk me out of the subtitle, so, but I called... well, let's stick with the title then. I called my book that I'm, you know, currently negotiating with a publisher on, Psychiatry and the Business of Madness. And why I call it the Business of Madness is precisely because it is a business and it runs like a business. It's made to look like it's not a business, but there are huge profits to be gained. And you know, about 20 years ago, a guy running for the head of the American Psychiatric Association who got in as president of the American Psychiatric Association, when he was asked, when he was running and he got in under this platform, what's the most important thing for you to do as president of the Psychiatric Association? He said, to increase the profit margin of my members. Right? Well, this is a very telling, this doesn't sound like to do no harm. And this doesn't sound like to serve the public good. This sounds like to serve the profession. Now, Psychiatry is not alone. Psychiatry is not alone. Every profession that professionalizes is out to serve themselves. But the paradigm of the professionalizing profession, you know, medicine is one of the paradigms, by very, very, very clearly.
That is something else. And so, yeah, and the way that it just, with... Great government supports that it is just growing.
Well, and great government support, and let's not leave out the other huge support. I mean, psychiatry would have lost in a number of ways in the 70s, and it would have been defeated if it weren't for the power of the drug companies. Psychiatry made an unholy alliance with the drug companies in order to make all of this look medical and to drive out their competitors, and that was the alliance, and that's the brain damage everyone's paying for that alliance from.
Mm-hmm.
And drug companies have no end of money. You know, this is a huge, huge industry, the drug companies, and you better be sure they want to maximize profits.
Right, and that's where their goal is, and so when it's profit-driven, people, it doesn't really matter, and this is where the real human rights violations are occurring, because they're just going at us, 10, 13 drugs, each person is on, starting
well, you know,
babies,
you know,
on these drugs.
Absolutely. One of the people I interviewed huge numbers of people for what was called the Psychiatry Project, which all then contributed to Psychiatry and the Business of Madness. But one of the groups, obviously, I interviewed, as well as psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, is one of the groups, obviously, was psychiatric survivors. And some very interesting stories about the difference, because you asked about it, the difference before and the difference now came out. The most telling one was by Irit Shimrat, and I said, when I asked what was the difference between psychiatry, when they got at you 30 years ago, and psychiatry when they get at you more recently. And she said the difference is that then she would have been on one drug or two drugs, and now they throw a whole plethora of drugs at her.
Mm.
The enormity, of the drugging of society. This is unprecedented. This is, Whitaker uses the term epidemic. It's metaphoric. It's a metaphor, but it's a very apt metaphor. We are creating an epidemic of brain-damaged people from the drugs. That's what's new about psychiatry, and that's what makes it so dangerous. It is destroying human minds in ways no one would have dreamt of being able to do 40 years ago.
Right. And do you want to talk about the degree of terror that people should be experiencing if they were actually being informed about what was going on and
well,
what
they
were...
Well, if people were informed of what was going on, they wouldn't agree to it. On the other hand, if they don't agree to it, they can be declared incapable of making treatment decisions, and it can be forced on them for their own good. So, one of the things I did in this research is I did 18 observations of meetings of the Consent and Capacity Board. That's the board in Ontario that people can appeal to for all sorts of reasons, but one of them is they've been declared incapable of deciding on treatment and decisions are being made for them, so they appeal to the board. And it was horrifying watching this, because any disagreement with psychiatrists was essentially called incapable. That was the proof of incapable. They didn't appreciate their condition, and they didn't appreciate that it would deteriorate if they didn't take this wonderful drug. That was the proof again and again and again.
At
so the stuff ended
allowed.
Up true by definition, not by evidence.
Great. And your work with people who are psychiatric survivors over the years, would you describe that and what that's been like for you? And
what particular work are you asking about?
Just work that you've done with the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault and Don White and other.
Oh, okay.
Other...
We have challenged stuff in the government. We have raised awareness. We have created educationals. We have created speak outs where psych survivors can bear witness to what's happened to them. And Dawn and I have been working together forever. It's been a long, long time, the early 80s. We started in Phoenix Rising, working together in the early days of Phoenix Rising, which was a magazine that gave voice to the psychiatrist, and we continued ever after. So some of this was writing, some of this was protest in the streets, and we certainly have all been to a huge number of protests. Some of it was educational, some of it was testimony. So there was a broad range of ways in which we battled psychiatry. What I think we have achieved is a certain degree of awareness in some people. I couldn't say that we've had any kind of major impact on government or on psychiatry.
And I think that that's where the fight needs to go on. I do have a caller on the line from area code 617. Your line is open.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I on the line?
You're on live. Do you have a question for Bonnie Bristow?
Well, just an observation. This is Naomi Pinson. I'm from Cambridge, Mass. So I'm 66, and I was 16 when I was hospitalized, first in a private hospital and then in a state hospital, for each one lasting about a year. And then I worked in a state hospital about 5 years ago, going back 9 years now. I worked there for about 4 years as their quote-unquote human rights officer. So I can tell you that things are much worse today, even though they were beyond horrible when I was there when I was 16. So, you know, I concur with what basically what I think she's saying about, you know, the sort of the hegemony of the mental health authority, how it's growing and getting stronger and more draconian.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's a shame that this is that it's getting worse and it's getting stronger and that they're developing more ability to silence people. And I think that's one of the things that really most concerns me about the way that when people do speak out, that they're silenced or retaliated against, and especially if they're working in a position of where there's somebody who's out about having a psychiatric history. Or lived experience, and they're in one of these, you know, peer roles or something like that. And so I think that it's getting worse, and we need to keep attention on it. Bonnie, I'm wondering if you have any other ideas that you'd like to talk about. I know there are several projects that you're involved with, coming out with Psychiatry Disrupted, and I'm wondering if you'd like to talk about any of those issues or...
Well, I've been busy generating literature, because one of the things that we know in academia is you gain credibility for things by creating literature that academia thinks is credible. So, you know, my colleagues in the disability movement have had made huge inroads by theorizing psychiatric stuff as in critical disability lens, and people, academics who use the MAD language have done a lot in terms of MAD history, etc. I've done things within anti-psychiatry, and you know, with Psychiatry Disrupted, we were looking at it's the same thing we were trying to get in Psychote. You know, and it's kind of hard to get, and that's to have people actually not simply critique psychiatry, but theorize how to resist psychiatry. So an action-oriented focus, which is looking at activism. So that's the focus of this book. It is the first anthology to do such a thing, and so we're very excited about it, and it's an international book with contributions from people in Canada, the States, and England. So that's one project I'm in. I'm also, and you're part of the, you know, you're part of this other project. I'm also about to launch a huge, you know, a number of workshops in a project that I'm calling Psychiatry Interrogated, and the purpose of the workshops is to bring institutional ethnography, which is a mode of dealing, of doing research, together with critical investigations of psychiatry, to bring those together so that with institutional ethnography, psychiatry once again ends up a pivotal institution that they look at, and with with people who investigate psychiatry, giving them a new skill or helping people acquire a new skill, because institutional ethnography is one of the most rapid growing forms of research and very much fits psychiatry. So that's one project I'm involved in right now. For the next few months, I'm going to be doing workshops in it, and then people from around the world will be doing their own institutional ethnographies, investigations into a number of aspects of psychiatry, and at the end we'll have an anthology, and there's 32 people, 32 contributors involved, some survivors, some not, some institutional ethnographers, some not. You know, so that's exciting. For
and
me
I'm very
right
excited
now,
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very excited. July 7th begins the first of the workshop, so I'm aware, and I'm also aware that I used institutional ethnography as one of my methodologies in psychiatry and the business of madness. So I've paved the way also for a book like this to come out, which is really interesting, and the obviously for me right now the project I am most involved with is precisely bringing to fruition Psychiatry and the Business of Madness, which I had two projects that contributed to it, the Psychiatry Project and the Madness Project, and it involved interviewing hundreds of people, doing observations of the Capacity Board of Ontario. It meant it involved analysis of hundreds of documents, et cetera, so, and medical analysis and historical analysis. So I'm particularly excited about this book because, you know, when you've written something and you know this is by far the best thing you ever have written and the best thing you ever will write, it's this book. And
wow,
so I'm really, really looking forward to this book eventually signing a deal with a publisher and bringing out this book, because I know how good it is, and when I decided to write this book, I was talking to my friends and I said, you know, I'm 69 and I'm not healthy. Well, I'm 69 now, so I must have said I was 65 and not healthy, whatever it was. I don't know what to do next. And everyone had suggestions for me. And I said, you know, Heidegger, who's a philosopher, existentialist philosopher, said that if you want to know what's most authentic to you, for you to do, project yourself toward your death. And so I said, if I die tomorrow, what would I regret not having written? What would I regret not having done? What would be missing? And after going around in circles for months and months and months, I knew instantly, within like a few hours of asking that question, it was this book. You know, so I feel, you know, so it's very personal to me in the sense that I knew this was the incomplete thing. I had never done something that holistically took on psychiatry in all its facets, and this book does it.
It's just amazing, and how you came to that is really inspirational, in that, you know, here I am in the crisis, and what do I, you know, what is it that matters to me, what is real, and that this is the way you're going. And the idea of, you know, what you had shared with me of this idea of combining medical research and historical research, I think also with the institutional ethnography and the critical discourse.
Social discourse analysis, yes, yeah.
It's,
so,
yeah.
And you know, it looks at all facets of psychiatry of the institution, including how the various professions that come into it, what is the training that prepares them to do what they do. So I trace how nursing happens, how psychiatry happens, how social work happens, psychiatric social work, how psychology in when it serves psychiatry, how that happens, and how that education prepares people to do what they do in these institutions. So that's an almost a totally untheorized area. So there were a number of things like that where, obviously, when I did a chapter in the DSM, well, I like to think mine is a particularly good chapter. Lots of people do a chapter in the DSM, but I was hitting areas no one had ever touched. So, because I really wanted a holistic thing that when people walked away, they would be able to say, now I understand what's going on. The other thing that made this book terribly important for me is what I know is that when there are really good critiques, there's almost nothing said, you know, a few lines, you know, a few paragraphs, a few pages about what do we do now. And I write 65 pages, a huge chapter on, if we got rid of psychiatry, what do we need to do to, you know, so that people are okay, so that we have a society that people can live on, you know, live in in a real, authentic, and meaningful way. And that's been a badly under-theorized area. And when it's theorized in a very narrow way, as if all we do is create services and we can leave society as it now exists intact. And no, we need to change society and then look at in a more holistic and commoning society, what would services look like?
Well, I think that this idea of what should society even look like, what does society need to do in order to change, in order to have, if you took out psychiatry.
If all we did is take out psychiatry, we would just put some other despotic institution in its place. I mean, psychiatry came out of what we are. We need to change what we are.
Right, and particularly in the States, I mean, we're in such a crisis here in terms of these, social kinds of issues. If the issue is economic, why is the response psychiatric? So if the issue is somebody doesn't have money to pay for rent, why is the answer to give them some drug?
The individualizing of social problems is, of course, what psychiatry is about, and the centrality of what you do will depend on the questions you've asked, and if you ask questions that lead you to individualize and pathologize, then that's what you'll do. If you ask questions saying, how did we generate this so that nobody can pay their rent, then you change society.
Right, and I hope that you'll talk about that a little bit more. We do have another person who's calling in.
Great.
Area code 646, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, how are you?
Good. Lester.
How are you? Yeah, it's Lester.
Good, hi.
I had a call and talk to the academic. You knew I was going to do that.
No one's ever called me that, but go ahead.
Well, they don't call Lauren an academic either, but she is.
Yeah.
You're on live.
I am fascinated by institutional ethnography.
Are you?
Uh-huh.
What are you fascinated about?
That spoke to me, because when we were doing Lauren's dissertation, a lot of talking about the institutions came up,
mm-hmm.
and the hooking of those institutions together. And it
Absolutely.
Even played out in terms of historical stuff, in terms of economics. Because one
Absolutely.
Of the things you discovered is patients who had means were on better floors and better served even in state institutions than those who were not of means, and they were always on the lower floors,
mm-hmm.
kind of like near the bottom of the sewer, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so...
So it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we don't do enough institutional analysis of any sort, you know, whether it's institutional ethnography or some other form of institutional analysis. We definitely need to do them, because medicine is one thing, false medicine is one thing, and institutions which reflect the bureaucratic and oppressive nature of society is a whole different dimension.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. It's an animal. What it is, and the way that it's, I think the historical. I mean, I'm just fascinated to have found some of the, firsthand accounts from the 1850s and the Opal and these inmates who are writing about going in for our liberation and brother and sister lunatics and that there, there was
mm-hmm.
a clear liberation movement
there
of lunatics.
There certainly was.
In the 19th century, and how everybody in the 21st century, like all the way through the early 2000s, had no idea, and people, scribbling and squabbling about, I was the first to do this, and it was like, no, this was being done 100. When I learned that this was going on for 100, and that the state had been lying to us and not,
Yeah.
part of the people who were saying, oh, this is the first time this has ever happened, we have to go slow about this. Meanwhile, in the 1850s, in their own books, they're using the word recovery. And so, you know, like the lies and the fraud.
And you have the brilliance of Mrs. Packard, who, you know, who fought with a writ of habeas corpus to get out of, you know, out of the grip of the institution, who was very, very clear and, you know, that this was a fight for liberation, and had this happened to her 2 centuries earlier, she would have been burnt as a witch. She was completely right. And very, very clear, and very, very clear what this liberation needed to look like.
Right. Right, absolutely, and that it was, and then that, like, Dorothea Dix shows up fighting Packard.
Yeah.
You know, and
Will,
that this,
there you go. Will, you know, there's always been, you know, whenever any profession is on the growth, they always have people who popularize them and see it as, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, and this happened here, and this has happened, you know, everywhere.
Lauren, can I say something?
Sorry?
When we talked about it in terms of the dissertation, we talked about it in terms of present-day movement, in terms of consumer survivors and ex-patients.
Yeah.
And we likened, for me at least, I likened Elizabeth Packard to a survivor of the movement, like, Her work is much more rights-focused, and psychiatric survivors, usually when we work, we always think of rights first. That's the battle cry for us.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's no question that
rights.
That's what Packard was suing too.
And Dorothea Dix, we saw more as a reformer, so we talked about her in terms of, for me at least, it was that she was a consumer. A modern-day consumer, she just wanted better services. And when you hear
that's right. And ultimately, someone who just wants better services will not overthrow a problematic system. They will not.
Right.
If
and
anything,
there we are.
They will make it more firmly entrenched.
And there we are, and that's where the problem lies.
Absolutely. And there's a certain divide and rule that happens with survivors, right? You know, I mean, it's very much in. It's very much in the interest of government and psychiatry to give money to those survivors who say, well, you know, we like the services, we just want them a bit better, as opposed to giving it to ones who say, we don't like the system at all, we want something different.
Great.
Well, I mean, and then it just grows,
and it grows more. I'm sorry, Lester, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that changes the dynamic, because then it's about haves and have-nots. So even poverty then becomes interjected into that, because then those who say, I don't want this at all.
Yes, indeed.
Let me create something different are the ones who end up in poverty, and then they end up attacking those who are more willing to side with the system. More willing to do the bidding of the system, so to speak.
Well, there's a division.
The
there's a division. There's a division, and the division is in one group's interest, the system. It's not in any survivor's interest in the long run.
Well, no.
Not in any one of our interests.
Well, the more you entrench folks, the harder it becomes to resist.
If you co-opt folks by giving them money, you destroy a movement.
Well, that's what's happening for us now.
I think that's what's happening for us now.
We're being destroyed because of so much
co-optation.
That's happening
if we think it's happening in Canada, it's happening in a far bigger way in England, where I don't think in England the survivor movement knows what's hit them, because you know, they're all being, you know, there's this huge amount of money for, okay, now you can be this in the university and you can be that, and people are funded, and in the process they are silenced. So they essentially kill the movement through that.
And that is an epidemic. I mean, that's one of the main things that Du Bois shows, that all over the country, all over the United States, people are being silenced and retaliated against in these peer positions when they take this money They think that they're going to be able to now have some more access and do some good. They get some attention because they're actually kicking things up and organizing and doing stuff. And so then the government throws money at them, and then all of a sudden they can't do what it was they had been doing fine with no government.
Yeah, but you mean there was a beautiful book that came out called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of all areas. The revolution will not be funded. And if you really want a revolution, you don't take money. You foment a revolution and you keep yourself without any conflicts of interest.
Well, as someone who is very much an idealist about this, because I went to work at one point in the belly of the beast. I mean, I was on a mobile crisis team for Parachute New York City. Parachute New York City is supposed to be a new program where people who are not in crisis, so who are in crisis but not a threat to injure themselves or others.
Gotcha.
And they're not homeless, can actually go, like, in a respite thing, and they assemble a mobile crisis team. Well, HHC, Health and Hospitals Corporation of New York City, had a mobile crisis team. Now, I went to work on it. Everybody was shocked that I went so far in the belly of the beast, but I kind of felt like Paul Warren had done it and others had done it. I'd never done that.
That's a misrepresentation. I'd never done that. But others do.
I wanted you to finish hearing what your thought was, though.
And I went in all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and all idealistic, and oh my God, did it turn real quick! I mean, I at one point, Lauren and I had many a fight over my choosing to do this. She supported me, and she supported me in the sense that she knew my heart was in the right place.
Yeah.
But going to work inside the system was really big. And I lasted all of 6 weeks because I couldn't
do,
I would not sell out. There came a point in time where I recognized who I was and what I was supposed to do. And I just said, I won't do it.
So
I had someone in a respite ask me, can I live medic? Can I hear voices or can I live without can I live without my medication and still hear my voices? And I said, yes, absolutely. You can live safely in the community without meds and still hear voices. I said, the only thing I'm going to say to you is please do not titrate up too quickly or down too quickly because this can cause relapse and you'll end up in the hospital. If you're going to do it, make sure you do it with folks who are safe. I said, and you have one of the best here to help you. And I gave him Will Hall's Coming Off a Psychotropic Medication to Begin to Read.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave him the resource. And the next day, I went to work, and I had the guy in charge of the program say to me, did you say? And I said, yes, I did. He said, you really believe it? I said, I absolutely do. I said, they are adults. They have the right and the dignity to fail. They have the right and the dignity to risk.
Well, good for you.
And
you found out it wasn't acceptable.
I was fired.
Well, but take a look. You went in the belly of the beast, and you maintained who you are and acted morally the whole time. And being fired being fired by an unjust system is a compliment. It also puts you without money, but it's a compliment.
I think what I'm beginning to learn is that those of us who are further on what I call the outskirts, whether it's academia or services or whatever, have to band together to kind of have our own economy. That's how I would phrase it. Because that way we support each other through the tough stuff. We support each other while we're trying to make sure we don't live on food stamps or live on public assistance or whatever, or public benefits or whatever.
The society we want to get in the end result is that anyway, where everyone supports each other, not where the government has handouts and not where the government takes care of people, but where people take care of each other, you know, and where we support each other and where we all give to each other. I mean, that's what we're trying to get to. That's the society we're trying to get to.
I mean, it's funny that, you know, you're in Canada, I'm assuming?
Yeah, oh, yes.
Ma'am.
I am.
And then I'm pretty sure you know David Rebel.
Yes, I do.
David was
on
Facebook.
For about 30 years, yeah.
Yeah, well, David was, I put a link up on Facebook today about USA Today is doing this whole series on MI, and because of what's been going on with the mass shootings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sent the link to Lauren and some others, and then I sent it to David, and then David, you know, hit me back and said something about, could I help him find self-help groups in Manhattan and this and that. I said, wait, are you going to hire me? Are you and Catherine going to hire me? You know, and we were laughing about it a little bit because, you know, try to sort of, well, because I will say this, working on Lauren's dissertation, I had the time of my life.
I'm
it
glad
was a
to
blast.
Hear
it was,
I mean,
it was
and
really
I loved so much.
What was your dissertation on, Lauren? I mean, I know it's in this area, but what was it specifically on?
Lauren's dissertation was in
Go for it, Lester.
Was an environmental community-based participatory action research.
Oh, great. Oh, fantastic. All right.
And it's called Devoiced. And it uses Goffman Cross as the base of its theory. So Goffman's asylum.
The concept of, yes.
Is the base, and then it crosses.
Labeling theory.
With
labeling
Black
theory.
Liberation Psychology of William Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And what it talks about basically is the encounter. What happens to someone when they're in the movement or in the position of being what you would call a mental patient or subordinate to the system, and what happens at that point of the encounter. So you meet someone like a me or a Lauren Tenney or a George Ebert or a David Oakes, and what happens in that encounter and how you move from patient stage into then like this immersion stage, and then you internalize it, and then you're liberated, and then it's almost this vow to make it different.
Yeah,
you're
and then we find out liberated to what, because who among us is really liberated, right? What a, the idea. So it sounds
like a really important thesis, Lauren.
It was phenomenal, and so much information came out of it, and so many things, and the videos, because we used video as a research tool, and so many people were involved, and it was just
terrific.
It was really, really amazing, and I think that, you know, one of the things that I've heard you talk about before, Bonnie, is this issue of if you're challenging the system is not going to give you money to do your research. They want,
correct,
you know, they've got like a carve out of what biological thing they're going to call things today, and
mm-hmm.
if you're not doing that, you're not getting funding. And so I feel awful because there were so many people who really supported and for years worked with me on this, and this was obviously an unfunded thing. And but now to even get, like, follow-up funding or to be able to help people get other work and opportunities to do participatory research kind of things.
Absolutely.
You know, and so as academics, like, or not academics, but as people who, like, operate in this academic realm, academics, I guess. You know, how do you have this battle and come out in a way of where if not, you know, because the other side is if you take the money, then you're compromised. So it's almost better
usually
to not have, you know, which
usually,
which
not always, but usually, you know. And some people manage to take a certain amount of money and operate at a degree of arm's length by which they can keep the system away from itself while they do some good. So it's not 100%, but it's complicated. I think in my whole time in academia, in terms of my research, the most money I ever took in was $2,000. Right? My stuff does not get funded. Right?
And it should, because you're brilliant and your work is brilliant. And
but
you,
I can,
you
but I can
shine
do it
light
anyway.
On...
You know, I can do it anyway. Nothing stops me from doing it. And so, you know, I don't need the funding in the end. You know,
right.
Now there's some projects if I wanted to do, I would need the funding, but the type of projects I set out to do, I don't need the funding. And now
well,
I found a way also to tie in the participatory precisely by doing this kind of training with anthologies and so on. So you can do phenomenal stuff without funding. You know, your life's a little bit harder than it would be if they thrown, like, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars at you.
Right. But then it's also got the freedom. But I do think that there, you know, with online technologies and different things like that, that there's all kinds of ways of making things more accessible than they had been. But still to find, you know, find some kind of, you know, getting support, even if the support is just access or authority. Do you know what I mean? If it's not necessarily financial, but being able to have some institution, you know, on that level to make it academic so that other academics...
Yeah, you can do academic work without academia. You know,
right.
I did two projects, both of which are going into, you know, entered into psychiatry and the business madness. And one was called the Psychiatry Project. And I took that through ethical review of the university. So in that sense, that was an academic, that was a, you know, a product tied to the university. And it was university forms I filled out, et cetera. But I also did a madness project, which I kept away from the university. And why? Because if I went through the university, I would have to play by the university rules, and there are times when playing by the university rules goes directly against what the movement, the anti-psychiatry movement and the MAD movement needs. And so any time I was touching on that, I did it through a non-institutional, I did not put it through the university. So I think you kind of figure out how to work those. So, for instance, if I did some focus groups, and what we decided is what we wanted to do with the focus groups is donate them to the Psychiatric Survivor Archives. And so then what was initially focus groups that were serving the book suddenly becomes historical archival material that people can use later. Had I gone through the university, they would not have been able to donate it because the university asks you to destroy your interviews within 5 years, essentially. Right? So you have to have to decide when the academic support is going to get in the way of your activism. Right?
Right. Right, and it has. This last time around, I had a good experience, but when I tried to do my field research back in 2005, where all I wanted to do was ask people to read the Opal and tell me what they thought about it, it was too controversial and would cause too much risk. And it was like, how is this even possible? I want people to read some books. Medical research. Medical research is like cutting people's brains open and shooting electricity through them.
Drugging them. By asking to read and having a decent conversation is putting them in danger. I know. What crap, huh? What crap?
You know, might give them an idea or something. Yeah, I don't even. So, but I think that these are, you know, for people to understand that even through all of that, if more people who were in academia came out about their positions in psychiatry or on psychiatry and voiced their question about, you know, blindly just following whatever it is they're being told, perhaps, you know, a couple of generations down of students coming out wouldn't have the same harshness toward us in the way that, you know, psychiatry encourages them to interact with us.
I will
call you back.
Sorry, what did you say?
I will call you back. I've been summoned, so I will call you back.
Okay.
You see, you have somebody keeping you honest here. That's always good. We all need that.
Bye. Thanks, Lester. I think that's part of the issue, is that there's always somebody who's going to be fooled by this because they're getting it from day one. That the books have been rewritten and that they have a clear message. I mean, psychologists and psychiatrists are the people writing this. Their entire field is to identify, define, predict, and control human behavior. Like, these are the people who know how to do it, you know? And they've got everybody marching in step. And it really is like, you know, the 1930s again sometimes. It really is like this fear of what it is that's going to happen to us once, you know, medical records or electronic are now, you know, once that's finalized and your electronic medical record is with you or what they're
wherever
doing.
Wherever you go.
Yeah, I mean, what they're doing to, like, veterans in the United States of where they've invested $70 million in this program through the Defense and Advanced Research Programs people to implant tiny devices into the brains of veterans who are showing signs of post-traumatic stress or you know, any psychiatric whatever.
Yeah, see, they're going to. I think the we got quote PTSD unquote as a diagnosis precisely because the veterans wanted something, and they're going to rue the day they wanted something. You know,
right?
They wanted something, and it was totally understandable. They wanted something. You can't get treatment without a diagnosis. They wanted the most innocuous diagnosis, and they originally wanted something saying nothing but that, you know, that they underwent, you know, they underwent combat, you know. But they ended up with one of the least and most innocuous diagnoses. But in fact, there is no such thing as innocuous diagnosis. So eventually, they can take that diagnosis and use that to just justify all sorts of horrible things happening. So this was initially a huge victory for the veterans, and now it's coming back to haunt them.
It really is in such a serious way, and. You know, the idea that they're implanting these devices to be able to reroute chemical impulses.
God,
and
help
then,
us. What did he think a human being is?
And that they're doing this on veterans of all people, like that people who have given their lives and have been injured, you know, like this is an injury. You want to talk about changing our society, Bonnie? Like how do we get rid of war? Like, let's start, like, you know, In a society that didn't require
absolutely, and in fact, in the book I wrote, I talk about how we need to shift to a society that is peace building as opposed to war building, and we can do that. We can do that. It's just that it's certainly not in a whole bunch of people's interest right now that we do that. You know, but you know the. You know, I'm a great believer in participatory democracy. If people started taking the power back that they've given to officials, that they've given to representatives, that they could give to, you know, that they've given to experts, and God help us, a society of experts is a horrible, horrible thing, a society run by experts. We can transform what we have, but we have to take back our power. And the beginning is, you know, Gandhi was very clear about the beginning. The beginning is by understanding that we can, that when you're dealing with a tyranny, you withdraw your consent to be ruled. We haven't withdrawn our consent to be ruled yet. We do that, you know, all sorts of things become possible. But we would have to have the average person saying, no, this is not the kind of society we want. And we have it. We have in pockets here and there people creating very different kinds of spaces together. If we can if we can nurture those liberated spaces and see them grow, we can make a change of a massive nature eventually.
I really hope so, and there are, I mean, I feel like there are more people that I'm in touch with now than ever before that see clearly why you don't have to, you know, why opposing something that causes brain damage and severe bodily injury and all kinds of other psychological and emotional effects, and not to mention what the withdrawal is like for, you know, people coming off of the drugs when they finally decide to, like, that this isn't a bad idea. Like, that this is, stopping this is not a bad idea and is something that we...
I mean, there's two things. One, there's the hegemony of psychiatry, so everyone thinks there's disease, and there are all of these diseases that need to be controlled, but there's also the opposite. There's also the opposite where the average citizen on some level knows there's an absurdity in this. If we can nurture their awareness of that absurdity, because on some level people do know there's an absurdity, then we can start winning this battle.
So an absurdity you're talking about, just of the
absurd. We've all seen it. We've all seen it. We've all seen, you know, TV programs where the psychiatrist is coming out with some ridiculous new disorder and the judge makes fun of him and everyone laughs. And even the people who hypothetically totally believe in the psychiatry laugh because on some level we know this is absurd. I think we can tap into that level. That's the level we need to appeal to.
That's really interesting because so much of it is absurd, right? Like shoot electricity through brain. Somebody doesn't want to live. Lock them in
cut
a tiny
out, cut
room
out part
by
of the
themselves.
Brain. Well, lobotomy. Let's cut out the part of the brain and see how they do with half the brain. You know?
Right.
Must be much better.
Crimes against humanity is what it is. It's just torture, and people need to speak out. There are like 10 people online, but none of them have flagged me that they want to ask a question. So I just want to make sure.
Come on, people, come on and ask a question or tell us something. So we're interested in hearing from you guys online. We really are.
Absolutely, and if you want to call in, also the number is area code 267-521-0167. Okay, and we've got area code 617. Your line is open.
It's Dorothy here, Bonnie. I just wanted to say hello to you. I think you and I emailed or talked a long time ago, and it's
this
really
is Dorothy.
Good to see you. I am Dorothy Dundas, and I live in Boston.
Oh, Dorothy Dundas, of course. I know exactly who you are. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too. And I've been listening. I was not able to tune in until about 9:30, but very fascinating, and best of luck with your book. It sounds fascinating.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all your work over the years.
Well,
you
you're more than welcome.
Many of us who've been doing this for a long time, we know who the other people who are who've been doing
it
for a long time, and we are so grateful for what you do.
I know. Well, I'm 70. I heard you say you were 69 or 60, something like that. I'm 73. And so, you and I, we've been at it for a while.
We've definitely been out for a while. It's funny, I started getting quite active in the social media fairly recently, and someone sent me a picture, and it was a picture of Dawn and I from 25 years ago, and I thought, oh, my God, I can't even recognize us. But, yes, you know, I think they were from 30 years ago. But, oh, yes, that's what we look like. Right?
Yeah.
We've been doing this most of our life, right?
Yeah. I've been doing it actively. I mean, I got out of the hospital finally 50 years ago.
Wow.
But then I didn't really find out about the movement until 15 years later. And so the minute I met Judy Chamberlain, that's when I started getting involved. And that was 1978. So I've been active since 1978.
That's a long, long time. Were you one of the writers in Madness Network News or?
No, I've done chapters in Daniel Mackler's book. I did a chapter in Beyond Bedlam where Judy wrote a chapter in that.
Oh, that's where I first saw your name, of course.
Yeah, way back. Yeah. About, discussing the electroshock and the insulin and all that. And I've been in touch with Don Weiss, and I've met Ron Bassman and Leonard Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't not a whole lot of us left.
But a lot of the people who've been fighting this fight for a long time are still fighting the fight. So Don's been fighting the fight since the late 70s, similar to you, and he's still fighting, and he's 84.
He was on a call a few weeks ago. I think he was on one of these calls.
Yes, and he was amazing, and actually. One of his poems was read, and it was just amazing. And his work over the years has been great.
Well,
he's
been an outspoken critic of the system for a long, long time, and he calls his poems rants, and they're beautiful rants, you know.
Mm.
Well,
yes.
Best of luck, and thank you so much for your work, Bonnie.
You too. Dorothy.
And Dorothy, I put that link up of where people can find Behind the Locked Doors poster that you made, and I'll make sure to get, I think I tagged you in it, but I'll make sure to get that out. And if you'd like to stay on the line, that's fine. But area code 810, your line is open also?
Hi, Lauren, Bonnie, and Dorothy, and all the others that are listening in. This is Loretta in Michigan.
Hi, Loretta.
Oh, yeah.
I've been sitting here listening and very excited about what I'm hearing from you, Bonnie, and the things that are happening.
Well, thank
and
you.
I just wanted to say hi.
Yeah, it's always good to say hi, you know. All of us who are fighting this system, we need to join up at different times and get to know each other and so on. It's a good thing, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. And Loretta, I don't know if you have any updates about your fight that you've been engaging in, but if you do, I'd be most interested in hearing.
I had a phone call from the foundation yesterday morning, and I spoke probably about just close to 12 minutes with the gentleman that called. He's apparently the director or the boss of the lady that had called me and got some information and then didn't bother to call me back. They're with risk management with the hospital in Lansing. And
okay.
I'm waiting. They're telling me that they have this assigned to them because I've had a problem getting my records. I don't know if I believe that, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt for now. I think that probably what I've asked for just plain does not exist, and that would be the informed consent forms. I don't believe that there was anything like that taking place.
Mm-hmm.
What did take place was a generic form for consent for surgery, and that form included billing my insurance company. And the ones that I've looked at, I did not fill them out. I only signed them. I didn't even date them.
They were all
filled out and dated, and then they told me, and repetitively, I was told, just sign here so we can bill your insurance company.
There you go.
And that doesn't sound like informed consent to me.
No. And
if
Bonnie,
that's institutional informed consent, which is no kind of information at all and no real consent. Yeah.
Nothing. I really have nothing in my records indicating that I was ever educated.
That's true of the vast majority of survivors I've talked to.
Yeah.
It's frightening.
Yeah.
And it's not what the public thinks. The public thinks everyone's got information.
Right. Well, what I have asked for is if those documents indeed do not exist, I have requested that in writing from them so that would be like me being able to complete my record, my medical
mm-hmm.
record.
Yeah.
It would be... I don't think that's going to happen because
mm-hmm.
that's admitting they did not teach me or my family about this treatment at all.
Mm.
But it's a request. You know,
right.
I had to put it out there.
And I'm not sure if you got the email, but Deborah Schwarzkopf from ectjustice.com did follow with the Office of Human Rights, and so it does vary from state to state what the focus of the Office of Human Rights is, but there are like 10 locations around the country that if you feel that you can't get your medical records because you're being discriminated against because of your psychiatric history, that they will then take that particular case. And perhaps because they've moved your records and they've said that they've assigned you because you've had trouble getting your records or whatever, that might be some level of discrimination that you're experiencing and because of the types of records that they are. And so maybe they would take that case in those places. And
the concern that I have right now is that these two people that I've spoken with, being part of the risk management, have both indicated that they were looking into my records, not asking the records department to provide that, but rather requested my records. And I haven't given permission for anyone to receive my medical records.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Those people, if they do have my medical records and they're going through them, they're going through them without my permission.
Mm. Right.
So, and I'm not certain how I can track that. I understand I'm supposed to be able to find out who has been requesting or looking at my records. But I'm not certain how to do it.
So is this the king power or the police power?
It sounds like a real mishmash to me. Record keeping is a bureaucratic thing. It didn't come with either police power or parents patriae. Records was, you know, as the institution grew, they kept records. And then they started creating laws on what kind of records needed to be kept. And then eventually, you know, human rights people started to say, but what about people having the right to their own records? You know, because that certainly didn't exist with the original concept of records.
Right.
Well, early on, when I was looking into the HIPAA and the right to my records and that, the booklet, at that time they had a booklet that was printable, and I don't even know if I still have that book, but it did state in that particular format that if they believe that me obtaining my records could be harmful to me.
Harmful to you, they can stop you from getting.
Then they could withhold them.
That certainly used to be the place in Canada. You know, I don't know what the laws are in the States.
I believe that, yeah, and how they can make this kind of determination up. But, yeah, they can redact whatever parts of your, under HIPAA.
And they do. You know, what I found in Canada, and I don't know, you know, what the experience is in the States, is that when someone wants their records, they send away for them and they get about a tenth of their records. And then they can ask for more and they get a little bit more. But if they really want most of their records, that the only way to do it is to get a lawyer to request it, because they somehow release it to a lawyer and they will not release anything except basic summaries of what those files are to the actual person.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I think there's also processes that the HIPAA is supposed to make this easier in the States, but in some cases, not so much. Area code 419, Loretta, if you'd stay on the line, 419, your line is open.
Yeah, hi, this is Pat Risser.
Hi, Pat.
Oh.
Hey, Pat.
Can you take yourself off speakerphone or lower the computer sound? Just some feedback, yeah.
I'm sorry, that better?
Great, yeah. Thanks. Hey.
Okay. I wanted to first of all thank you, Bonnie. I don't know that you get enough thank yous in the line of work you do, you and Lauren. And, you know, I wanted to say, you know, I've had 5 heart attacks and got heart issues and stuff, and I'm pretty convinced that it was due to a lot of years of taking psychiatric drugs. There's no way I'll ever prove that, and so I'm sort of content to live with the fact that I'll end up dying with that. But as I've been an activist for the past 30-some years, I've thought about why did I get into that? I mean, how did that happen? And I realized I was raised in the Midwest part of the country, you know, the old, you know, middle-class, hardworking people. And I was taught from infancy, the time I took my first steps, I was taught, if you have a problem, go see
doctor.
Trust doctor.
That's right.
Doctor will fix it.
Yes.
And so
That's
I was,
right.
So by the time I reached, you know, an age of consent, I was pretty brainwashed, and I think that most people are actually
Absolutely.
Fairly brainwashed into believing in this power of medicine. And I view my role for the past 30 years as kind of being a cult deprogrammer. But it leads me to the question of how did psychiatry then become accepted as a legitimate part of other medicine? They're sort of riding on the coattails of legitimacy in this go see Dr.
By creating medical appearance. By creating medical appearance. By using words like symptom, by dressing, you know, by dressing in a certain way, by talking about counterindicators, by talking about dual diagnosis, by more and more medicalizing all the language so that it looked as if it was medicine, right?
It
was medicine, and everyone's taught to trust doctors, then everyone's going to trust psychiatrists.
That might fool some people, but why does medicine accept psychiatry?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They do and they don't accept psychiatry. Psychiatrists are always complaining. You know, I interviewed a bunch of psychiatrists, and many of them complained, you know, that we aren't given proper credibility by our colleagues. They all think we're not a real science, and you know, so many of them don't, but they don't dare go against, you know, they don't dare say this too publicly that they don't, but psychiatrists are always complaining what they're using the word prejudice against them by other medical people. So, in fact, real medicine knows there's something totally phony about psychiatry.
Well, that leads me then to wonder if that should not be one of the points of attack of the revolution, if we should try to somehow decredential them as medicine.
Yeah, that would be nice, but very, very hard to do, given they go through all those years to become a normal medical doctor before they start doing their psychiatric rounds. So all of the education has actually given them the normal training of a real doctor, and then the other is the overlay on top of it. So they have really made it look that way. You know, they've created, you know, they go through rounds of cardiovascular and all the rest before they ever take the rounds as a psychiatrist.
Right,
so
the only real doctor
is creating this substructure that they really are doctors, right? Very, very hard to take that out from under. But certainly real doctors, as in people who actually practice medicine as we understand it, could be potential allies here. It's certainly a fairly untapped area. And if we were doing strategic activism, we might be trying to go for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
I never had one of my psychiatrists treat me for sore throat or an earache.
There you go.
They always had to call in a doctor. Even though the psychiatrist was a full-fledged doctor.
Yes.
They
well,
never,
if they never do it, eventually they forget what that's all about anyway.
Yeah.
They're doctors, but they never want to actually touch a patient. I think they all have a hand-washing phobia.
Are we all still on the call? This is Dorothy. Am I still active here?
Yes, Dorothy.
Oh, yeah, because I definitely wanted to speak to that, because I remember back when I was in the hospital, you know, there was a very clear line. The psychiatrists were not allowed to touch you. If you had a sore throat, if you had any physical problem, they would call in somebody else, and it had to do with some sort of rule about the psychiatrist literally not having much contact with you other than sitting across the room in a chair and remaining mute, totally mute in silence for 3 years. You know, so, I mean, I remember that happening a lot of times. Because sometimes when you were in there, the only way to actually have contact with somebody was just to be sick or, you know what I'm saying, like to say you needed to see a doctor. And, yeah, that's all I had to say.
I'm speechless.
Yeah, I mean the system is just disgusting and horrible.
Yeah.
Nice to hear your voice, Pat, too.
Ah, Thank you. Okay. Y'all take care. Thank you so much, Bonnie.
You're very welcome.
I've enjoyed
thank you for coming on. I every so often see things you post, so you know,
good to
have a voice to attach to.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Pat. And I do think that this is, you know, this is part of where we need to go. The revolution to overthrow these ideologies about what psychiatry can and cannot do, and what society is allowing it to do to all of these people. And Bonnie, I thank you so much for coming on and spending all this time and sharing your ideas and your work. And I understand that your blog can be found at bizomadness.blogspot.ca. Is that right?
It can, and it. We raced to get it up before this program, so it just went up a few hours ago. So you'll be visiting an almost fresh blog.
That's great. And I'm looking at it, and it looks absolutely fabulous. And if people want to reach you, that's bizomadness.blogspot.ca.
Not dot. Dot. I'm sorry. You had it absolutely right. Forgive me. Yes.
Bizomadness.blogspot.ca.
That's it. CA
and,
for American Friends means Canada.
Yes. And the thank you for having this conversation with us tonight. And I look forward to much work with you in the very, very near future. I want to thank everybody who listened and called in. And we will be on tomorrow night, 9 to 11 p.m., if you'd like to continue the conversation. I'm going to ask everybody to keep on speaking out. And until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Lauren.
Bye.